Hello. My name's Bill. I'm an alcoholic. Let me get my timekeeper going here. My old guy tools. My drink date is January 3rd, 1970. I've been sober 45 years. I got sober in New York the old-fashioned way, put the plug in the jug. That's the first thing I ever heard in AA. We're going to stop drinking, you put the plug in the jug. Everything else comes later. I like to get all the numbers out of the way so you're not doing any math in your head, like I do whenever I hear a speaker speak. I took my first drink at the age of 12, 11, 12, 13, whenever you become an altar boy, that age. I drank until I was 23. I'm 68. I'm a little bit past my anniversary. This time of year is always reminiscing for me, thinking about the last month of my drinking, first month of sobriety. I took my first drink in a church vested to serve a Roman Catholic funeral. There were five altar boys on the team. I was the new altar boy. Just before Mass started, this is a funeral, just before Mass started, the five altar boys were sitting in a circle, and the decanter with the wine went around the circle. We each took a slug. Maybe a soda pop type guzzle, maybe 5-7 ounces first time around. Second time around, maybe about 3 ounces, 10 ounces altogether, tops. This is what happened. I'm a birth defect child. I was born with a cleft palate. Not too many people survive a cleft palate birth. I'm one of the lucky ones. I had a terrific mother who kept me eating and breathing. I was short. I was about 1.5 feet tall until I got to the sixth grade. I sounded different. I couldn't talk too well. I was very windy. You really couldn't understand when I talked. And I was the ugly duckling. The surgery wasn't done until I was 15, so I grew up ugly. And these things banged around inside of my head all the time. And I was picked on in school, called names, dragged through mud puddles and, you know, stuff. Until this drink. And once I got that second drink in me, that all stopped. It all went away. It was like bulk erase. And the other thing that happened to me is I became very, very important. This guy that died was in the aisle in the mahogany box. Funeral, church is full. He'd given a lot of money to our church. He'd given a lot of money to the archdiocese. I felt more important than anybody in the church. The Cardinal Spellman was on the altar, and all of his assistants, I felt more important than all of them. I even felt more important than the guy in the box, and it was his big send-off day. And that qualifies me for the diagnosis of alcoholism because I had an adverse reaction to the first drink. It's like prerequisite membership here. interesting thing is I did not get involved with alcohol to the point where it was a problem, you know, at the age of 12. And I don't think I ever had a social drink because there's not too many 12-year-olds around to drink socially with. I found a drinking priest who drank much more than I did. And his name was Ben. And one Sunday, as a Catholic, you're allowed to serve 3 masses. So I served 3 masses, the limit. And I've been drinking all morning. And I came home and I kissed my mother hello. And she accused me of drinking. And I'm alcoholic. I denied it. She says, no, I can taste the alcohol and the wine on your breath. I go across the street and resign from the Altar Society, Altar Boy Society. So I went across the street and found this priest who had been drinking right along with me that morning. And I asked to go to confession. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I drink the altar wine. And Father said, no sacrament, no this, no bashalallah, no forgiveness, no penance, nothing. And then we began to play this stupid game where he said the 6 a.m. Mass every day, and I served the 6 a.m. Mass every day. And whoever got there first could drink first. And no matter how early I got there, he was always there. I get there at 5:30 for the 6, and I'd open the door. And you know that sound that the whiskey makes falling down into the bottom of the bottle, that swishy sound? Well, I don't have to explain that, do I? I see all the heads going now. You don't have to explain. I always heard it, so that meant I had to wait until after Mass, or if he sent me off the altar to get his second or third cruet full for the Mass, which he did every Mass, really. And he was my first power of example, my first real seeing of alcoholism. He died a very slow death across a two-year period, missing in action a lot. They took pieces of his limbs off and surgery, and drinking was never mentioned. He was just, he had a condition. That's what they called it in those days. If you have old aunts and uncles and grandparents, ask them about the condition. That's what they call drinking. Oh, his condition is acting up. I missed a year of school in high school, had to stay back a year. And all during that year, I was in and out of hospitals and had a lot of surgery done, and I couldn't see, and I couldn't talk, and I had tubes so I could eat, and the only thing I could do was hear and listen. So I listened to the radio a lot. New York City DJs got me through that year. Later on, I got to meet all of them by going to the station and asking to see them. And they encouraged me to do something with music if I wanted to, and they would give me records, and I had the hit records right away before anybody else. And I started playing records in my cafeteria in high school and parlayed that into a DJ business, mobile DJ business. I'm probably one of the first pioneers of the DJ performance business out in New York, 1964. And I had a 42-year run, very successful career, played a lot, traveled a lot. The piece that is very interesting is I always knew what I wanted to do. I didn't have to worry about going to job fairs and places where you have to figure out your IQ and if you use your right hand, it'd be an art or whatever. I always knew I wanted to be a DJ. I just didn't know how to, whether I was going to be doing it on the radio or live or behind a curtain. But within a year and a half after I started, I had it figured out and had a good run. So now I'm performing and drinking, and mostly drinking and performing, drinking volume from about the age of 15 on, starting to carry whiskey with me. I had a two-quart rule. If I opened the first of the two quarts, I had to get another quart. I was addicted to supply. It was one of my obsessions. You know, I might run out next week. I might run out, you know, or later today, depending on thirst. I thought I had a broken thirst when I got here. Towards the end of my drinking, I had one drug experience that I always share because it proves to me that I'm an alcoholic. I started to fall down at the end of my drinking as part of my work, and the time came where I couldn't get back up. After falling down, people thought it was part of the act, but it really wasn't. And a real good friend of mine, Fan, followed me around. His name is David. He called me and he said, "We got to get you off the alcohol, man. We got to get you on some real dry drugs so you can, you know, still be high but be able to perform and, you know, not fall down a lot." I'll be right over. So he came over. And he had probably $10,000 on his roll in his pocket, walk-around money, drug dealer. And he had this pipe, homemade pipe. You know what a thimble is that Grandma uses with the sewing, pushes the needle through so it doesn't hurt? He had a thimble with a little hole in the bottom of the thimble, and he had a bar straw stuck through the hole, and he had two dirty old Band-Aids taped around the bottom to keep the smoke from escaping from the little bar straw. And he had a boulder, a hash about the size of a booger, and he put it into the thimble, and he lit it, and he took one, and then he handed it to me. I took a little toke, he took a toke, I took a toke. And then I'm waiting for this drug kaboom to come in and do whatever it does. And I said, when is this drug thing going to start? He goes, you are so stoned. I said, no, I'm not. And yes, you are. No, I'm not. We did that for a minute. Yes, you are. No, you're not. Yes, you are. He goes, I'll prove it to you. Let's go down to the club, and I'll put you in front of a band, and you'll be able to hear everything separate, each string, each rat-a-tat-tat, and each word and syllable. And so I'm in the van. I'm driving. He's in the shotgun, and we're driving along, red light. Light turns red. So I stop the van, and he starts the drug talk. It's okay, you're doing good, there's no police around, you're going to be okay, we're about 200 feet from the light, so let's just ease off the brake and roll up to the red light. That's how stoned I was, and I didn't even know I was stoned. He put me in front of this band, and I could hear everything separate, like 16 things at the same time, and I could hear people driving by in their cars outside the club. I could hear them breathing. Right. 10. Everything 10. Bass treble. Clearness 10. Super aware and sharp. And no, that's not mine. Mine is drink, blackout, fall down, wake up tomorrow. That's my high. So it proved, and I've never wanted to do any kind of drug since that experience, other than medications that I was given during sicknesses or surgical procedures. And that proved to me that I'm really an alcoholic. I'm not an ANDA. I don't have the other stuff. I'm just an alcoholic, a pure alcoholic. Alcoholism is my thing. So let's zoom to the end of the drinking. We're talking 1969, Woodstock era. March of 69, I had a bad week. I got fired from a very good radio job. I also had my first car accident, and my parents asked me to move out of the house. All in the same week, all because of drinking. And I began to, up until that time, I never looked at my drinking. I always drank. I always drank as much as I could. Really never curbed the drinking at all. And this popped up this week. So I began to look at the drinking and think about cutting down or slowing down. I began to keep track. And it's very hard to slow down your drinking because you have to drink less to get the feeling that you're not drinking, but keeping track of the less drinking, you got to drink more to catch up with what you missed when you were drinking less, and it gets very confusing. So I stopped drinking completely for 10 days and had one little beer nip with a friend and off to the races until 5 o'clock in the morning when I came to. And then 3 weeks later, I got another dry period together, 21 days, and the same thing happened. There's a little walkout on the job that I got, and a union job. And everybody went across the street to drink because of the walkout, and there was no resistance to the first drink. And all of this happened before I had any knowledge of AA or alcoholism or the disease concept. Father's a doctor, mother's a nurse, no idea about drinking. So after the second failure to be away from alcohol, I despaired. I just figured, well, there's cops and there's priests and there's baseball players and there's drunks, and I fit in the drunk part. I'm a drunk, and that's what I do. So I'm just going to drink. And I drank with no holds bar. Didn't keep track of anything. I met Maddie the caddy that week. Maddie lived at the Westchester Country Club in one of the traps on the 17th green. And big drinker, and I met him down at the Palatial Hotel Senator, which was the Skid Row in my town, and he talked about not having blackouts. Not having blackouts. He goes, yeah, I drink all the time. Oh, so I began to drink all the time and didn't have any more blackouts, and I had a New Year's Eve party, 6970, where I invited all my nightclub friends and owners and musicians and hangers-on. And I drank probably 20 quarts of booze across 4 days. They all brought me booze. They were doing drugs. They didn't need booze. So they left me alone after the party with many, many quarts, and I drank a lot of it, almost all of it. And strange stuff happened that weekend. Police came often, and I signed my name to papers, letting them know that they had been there. There was limbs and boulders in my apartment, a lot of sand. Don't know where it all came from. At the last 2.5 months, 3 months of my drinking, I had stopped eating. And I got rid of all of the food stuff, like pots and pans and plates and forks and knives and all that. I didn't eat any of that because I'm drinking. Hence, the cabinets over my kitchen sink were empty. So I kept my stereo in these cabinets, and these cabinets were bolted to the main wall that ran the whole length of this apartment complex, probably 65 apartments across 3 floors. And this is back in the day where there were records. Remember records? The circular things with the hole in the middle? 33 1/3 RPM records. And Led Zeppelin II was brand new. And my copy skipped for about 4 days. Holonic, 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 holonic. Holonic, 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 holonic. 2 days of that. Weed. 10 hours of that. Everybody in the building thought I was dead. Somebody came down and read my name off the door and called everybody in the phone book with my last name, Donovan, and they found my sister, and she put together a posse, and they all came over. And my sister, the nurse, who just graduated from nursing school, was brought in by my father because he felt she might know something about alcoholism. Of course, she got, I think, 18 minutes of training across the 4 years in nursing school about it. And my father thought I had done drugs, and I had not done drugs. I just had been drinking a lot. So they brought me back to my father's house and put me in the basement, and they used the old-fashioned Irish cure. They keep you awake for the first 24 hours, and then they let you sleep for 24 hours. This was Saturday they came, and Monday my father took me back to my apartment and said, son, I don't know anything about this drinking thing. You're on your own. And I went back into my apartment and looked at the boulders and the sand and the limbs and remembered I had a job, phone company, so I went back to work. And they had a big meeting with all of the management, probably 4 levels of management, big district guy. And in that meeting, they asked me what I've been doing for the past 2 weeks, because I've been missing without any attendance or call-ins or anything. And I told them, point blank, I've been sitting on my floor drinking around the clock, and I can't stop. And is there a place for drinkers in the phone company? His fourth liner says, no, there's no place for that kind of drinking here. I'm going to put you on final warning. I've been with the company not quite 2 months, already on final warning. Usually it takes 2.5, 3 years to step down in a union shop to get to the final warning announcement. Final warning right away. I was told if I screwed up or drank or both, I'd be fired. And he said to me, you got yourself into this. You got to get yourself out of this. Coming out of that meeting, that's the drinking part now. Coming out of that meeting, I met my union delegate, Tipsy. Now, Tipsy, yeah, it is funny, isn't it? Tipsy was my union delegate, and it's 8:10, and he's so intoxicated he has to lean against the wall. And Tipsy was 5 foot everything, 5 foot tall, 5 foot wide, 5 foot front to back. He weighed about 600 pounds. And when he would get drinking, if you looked at his belt and used the belt as like the equator, he would start to tilt and his belt buckle would be almost up at eye level when he was really drinking. And he couldn't talk because all the fat is crushing down. And he said to me, if you try to do something about your drinking, I can protect your job. And I said it fast, really fast here. It took him about a half hour to say all that. And he gave me a crumpled up piece of paper with a George and a 212 phone number. He says, call this guy. He knows about drinking. So I went across the hall to where I was working. I was on the frame, New York telephone frame, running new lines was my job, new hire. And I went to my foreman. Tipsy says, I got to call George. He goes, yeah, go call George. So in the phone company, there's ladders. They're about 2 stories high, and they take care of beds of shelves of cables. And you have to put your protective cones around the bottom of the ladder when you're up there so somebody doesn't come along and take the ladder while you're on it. So I got my cones. I'm up on the ladder. I call this number, and a woman answers the phone and asks, is this Bill? That's me. I had broken thinking. I'm 4 days from the last drink. I didn't hear you well until it went in and hit the screen. And then I could read, is this Bill? Yes. He goes, my name's George. I'm a vice president down here in New York. And when I started drinking, and he told his story without breathing, he asked, was I on a ladder? And I said, yes. He goes, well, I was on that ladder 10 years ago. I had just punched my foreman across the street in McCann's, where we would go for lunch and drink Scotch sours. And my foreman and the police were waiting at the bottom of the ladder, so after I made the call, they could arrest me. And he told his whole story from that, and talked all about blackouts. I knew I had them every day once he told 2 or 3 of them. The fear of running out, I had that fear of losing supply, fear of losing money to create the supply, all of that. The only thing that I didn't have that he had a lot of is his wife kept finding his bottles. I didn't have that problem because I wasn't married. But other than that, he told my story. It's a regular alcoholic story that you hear all the time. And he said he knew some guys right near where I lived, and he'd call them and see if he could get me an AA. So Saturday morning, 5 days dry, phone rings at 7 in the morning, and it's Screamin' Ed. Now, Screamin' Ed screamed because he was deaf and he couldn't hear himself, so he would scream. And he asked me 3 questions. I won't scream. Is this Bill? Yes. Are you having a problem with drinking? Never heard it quite put that way. Problem with drinking. That went right in. I didn't have to read it. That went right into wherever it is. Yes. He goes, you know where the Sherwood Diner is? Yes. I'll meet you there in an hour. Click. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, how he's going to know me and how I'm going to know him. We didn't make up any secret code. I'll have a yellow coat on, you'll have a red umbrella. When I drop my glove, you open your umbrella and I'll know it's you. You know, none of that stuff. So and this diner is packed at 8 o'clock in the morning in January. The hunters stop to get their coffee and butter roll before they go hunt or do whatever they do. I don't know what you do when you hunt. And I'm walking in this front door, and I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to know this Ed guy. And I hear from over this side in the corner, "Hey, over here. Get over here." Oh, right over, and I said, "How did you know?" He said, "Sit down." Well, I knew that "sit down" didn't answer "how do you know?" So I sat down. I didn't know what else to do, so I sat down. And he told his story, 20 minutes of that. And he had a new guy, Terry, with him, who had 5 months. And Terry told me his story. And Terry was the baby. Terry was 13 years older than me at that time. He was right around 35, and I was 23. So I was if I came in and stayed, I would dethrone him as the young person. And he smoked cigarettes, and he held the cigarette between these two fingers, very weird. And he looked around a lot. Always looking. Ed would get up to use the restroom, and I'd start talking to Terry. "Terry, I don't want to be going to meetings with an old guy. Can I go with you?" And Ed would be coming at me. And then the check came, and I'm ready to pony up my, you know, for breakfast. And he goes, no, you don't pay. We take care of all this. And I go, "Can I leave a tip?" "No, you can't leave it. You can't do anything." And I said, "I got to do something." He goes, "What you do is you take the new guy that you find to his first breakfast. Trust me, it would have been much better if I paid my own check that day, because I bought thousands of dollars worth of breakfast." So right at the end of this, we're leaving, and Ed determines that Terry's too whacked to drive to the meeting that night, so I'm going to pick Terry up and drive him and me to my first meeting. And the last thing Terry said to me leaving that diner was, "Just come and go with me. Just come with me to the meeting. Just come to the meetings with me." So that started it. That was probably January 8th or 9th, around there. Drink date is January 3rd. We go into the first meeting, and they bring me right up front to right this area, just like you and me talking right up front. And they introduced me to Vinny. Now, Vinny is Italian, Sicilian Italian, pinky ring with a light show. You know, he would stand under the lights and twinkle it in me, you know. So he smoked cigars about that thick. He couldn't even get his finger up, you know, around the top of the thing. And he got right close to me, really close to me, and he poked me like punctuation, making a point like commas and capital letters. He got right up close and he goes, "You're not going to drink. And if you ever drink, I'll find out about it." And then that patented South Jersey hook nod, you know. You know, I'm a performer. I've worked in nightclubs. I've worked for mob guys. I know if you misbehave, you're gone, you know, literally. So I was scared. I knew I wasn't going to drink anywhere near Vinny if I drank. Next sentence, he said, "Come on." He took me back to the coffee urn. Do you have one? Yeah, you got one in the back. I'd only seen him in diners, you know, with the glass tube where you see the coffee go down when you, and it bounces. You know, I was fascinated by the coffee thing. And you have real cups here, which is way cool. And he would put the cup under the urn, and he put like half the coffee in, and then he put a splash of milk in, and he put one sugar in, and he'd start stirring it and get it all going. And when it's swirly, swirly, he put the second sugar in. And I'm standing there, you know, with him, watching this. And he goes, "Do you see that?" "Yes." He goes, "Do you think you could remember that?" "Yeah." He goes, "That's how I like my coffee. You're going to get my coffee. Everywhere we go, you're going to get my coffee. Can you remember that? Can you do that?" And truly, up till now, this next sentence is where I made a decision to be in AA and do this. So, yes, I can do that. And we went everywhere, and he'd be back there talking with the old-timers like us, and real cool, and he's the speaker, and then he'd look for me, and he'd go, "Whoa, coffee, where's the urn?" Then, once I brought him his coffee, he would walk me up front and put me in my seat, on the aisle, right in front, and he would sit next to me, everywhere we went. 3 weeks later, I'm an old-timer now, 3 weeks. And there was a new guy sitting in my seat. I got all upset. I went up to Vinny. Vin, somebody's in my seat. He goes, "Yeah, that's Al. He's at his first meeting. You're going to sit in my seat tonight." Oh, so it's Al, me, and Vinny. Vinny leans across me and introduces me to Al. "Al, Bill, Al." Bill was just at his first meeting a couple weeks ago. "Yeah, I was at my first meeting a couple weeks ago." And so Vinny goes, "So? Come on, Al. First you put the cup under the urn like this, and you put a little half in the coffee, and you get the milk going, and you get the second sugar and let it trickle down. Now, there's something to this coffee thing, because since I've been getting Vinny's coffee, I haven't had a drink. And I don't know, I can't figure it out, but I'm going to keep doing this. And if for some reason I'm not here, you'll know how to make Vinny's coffee, and you can get his coffee for him." And I'm all proud about this, you know, victory, if you will, at the coffee urn. And the two of us come back, and I tell Vinny, you know, that Al knows how to make you coffee now in case I'm not here. And Vinny got very upset. He stood up, and he goes, "Get up, stand up," right at this close. He goes, "You will never not be here." "I will come and get you and bring you here. I don't need no Al to get me my coffee. You're going to get my coffee. You got that?" "Yes, sit down." "Okay, bang." And that's how it was for the first year and a half, 2 years. And no big book. We didn't talk about big books or steps or anything. Get in the car. It was the big book instruction, if you will. A lot of 12-step work with drunks. And my instruction when I was taking on a 12-step call was to say nothing. Just be there. And watch. And these guys were way worse than I ever was and were dying right in front of me. And never did get sober and never came to meetings. And this was back before detoxes and rehabs and treatment centers. And the only hospital in the country that would treat an alcoholic was Rockland State. And Rockland State was a mental institution. But they were the groundbreakers in medicine. So this one time, we were going to meet a very famous chemist who had been published in. I didn't know him, but Vinny knew of him. And right in the middle of us walking into this house, he goes, "Now, I'm going to give you the signal, just like the coffee signal. And when I give you the coffee signal, you breathe in through your nose." "Got it?" "Got it." But we're in, telling stories, and this guy's huddled in the corner. And we're having a great time, and Vinny's telling stories, and Bob was with us. And all of a sudden, Vinny gives me the look. You know, so I took this big deep inhale, and it smelled like a sewer, very crappy sewer, bad, very bad, mixed with body odor and the smell of whiskey, and very bad smelling. And so I asked Vinny on the way home, "Why did I do the sniff thing?" He goes, "Just so you know. You understand?" "Yeah, I understand." If you ever drink again, you'll wind up like that. And we'll be able to smell you from Cleveland. So, over the years, I have been through the steps 4 times with 4 different sponsors. I did some reminiscing this past 3 months, and I counted up the groups that I've been in and counted up the sponsors. I've been in 8 different AA groups, 2 of the groups twice, so really only 6 AA groups with 2 tenures and 2 of them. And I've had 7, maybe 8 sponsors, 2 of them twice, so really only 5 sponsors over my time. And I've always had a sponsor since my first meeting. I'd like to go through the steps really quickly, if that's okay. The part about being powerless over alcohol and my life being unmanageable came to me when I woke up from the last drunk. I didn't have to work that step. It was a knowing inside that was given to me freely by the greater power, higher power, whatever you want to call it. I was brought to the meetings, and I began to complain at the meetings about everything, like the coffee's too hot and it's too smoky, and the toilet seats are cold, and speakers talk too long, la, 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 la. And Vinny pointed out that I was coming to, second step came to. And I figured out all by myself, which is the job of each individual, to figure out your own power greater than yourself. My power greater than myself was the great power of example that's in the meetings, that's active and alive right now in this instant during this breath. You guys are here doing the same thing I am. You're at the meeting. You're not drinking, unless you are. And you're trying to continue sobriety or figure it out. Great power of example. And there's no God concept in the second step. It's a power, power greater than me. And then the third step for me was Vinny had spoke up in Albany, and we were on the way home from Albany, driving down to the New York State Thruway, and he pulled off the road and into the grass, and he turned around and he looked me right in the eyes. He goes, "So, are you in this?" "In what?" "In AA." "Well, I go to the meetings, I get your coffee, I sit up front, I do what I'm told, I get in the car whenever you tell me." "Yes." He goes, "And you're done with the drinking?" "Oh, definitely done with the drinking." "Good." And he turned around, got back on the road, drove home. About a week later, I asked him about that. He goes, "Yeah, you took your third step that night. You decided to be here. You're done, you're in, you're going to do whatever's next." So, not right away, but I did a fourth step. When I had about 3 years, I did an autobiography and gave it to a sponsor and didn't get any new information and got stalled there for about 3 or 4 years. And then I got another sponsor who got me up to the seventh step, and there was really no magic there. We didn't do too much in the seventh step. Then I got a third sponsor, and we went all the way through everything, but rush through. It took about a month. And then in 1994, I moved to the West Coast and got a sponsor out there. I asked him to be my sponsor, and he goes, "I'm going to give you one thing. I admire a man who has 24 years who would come to me, who only has 13, to get more information. That's all I'm going to give you. The rest you got to earn." And he said, "We're going to start with the third step. We're going to hold hands here." We did our work between the two cars in his garage. And he had a little card table between the two cars. And we held hands and we read the third step prayer out loud, which I had never done. I've never said it out loud in my own voice so I could hear myself saying it and sort of declaring it, if you will. And that was a very different experience. I had goosebumps during that. And then he gave me my fourth step instructions and 4 parts, resentment list with the columns right out of the book, the fear list, the bullet list, listing all my fears right out of the book, the sexual inventory, explains what to do and how to do it in the book, and then the ideal relationship paragraph where you write down three or four things that you want out of a long-term relationship. And I went home and I did a list a day, skipped a day, went to meetings. A week later, I had the fourth step done. I called him, and I forgot to mention it. It's an hour and a half each way to his house from where I lived, over the Santa Cruz Mountains. He lived in Santa Cruz. I lived in Pleasanton, East Bay. And I get there with my list, and we sit down at the card table, and I give him my list. He goes, "What's that? I don't get that. What's my fourth step? Well, I don't get that." Oh, and I look troubled, you know. It was very easy to confuse me. He goes, "So what?" His nickname for me was Coogan. Don't know where that came from. He calls me Coogan. And I said, "Yeah, you can call me Coogan. What do I call you?" He goes, "Either Forrest or Mr. Meacham." No, cool, no. Oh. So he said, "What usually happens when you do your fourth step?" Well, I give it to the sponsor reads it, and then we move on to the next thing in the six and seven. He goes, "Good, so," and this is key, "you," and this is Forrest talking to me, "you have never voiced the exact nature of your wrongs out loud in your own voice to another human being." And I went, trying to figure out a way to say yes. No. He goes, "Good. Read the resentment list." So I read the resentment list, and he's taking notes, making notes. "Good. Now read the fear list. Just read it like you wrote it." And I stopped after the first one to explain it. He goes, no explaining. "Just read what you wrote. No talking. This is reading out loud." Back to the list. He goes, "Read the first one again without the explanation pause that you were getting ready to tell me 18, 20 hours worth of crap." Oh, I got it. Read one, two. I had 19. Then the sexual inventory, which was, I thought, you know, very interesting and long and decorative and marvelous. He kept saying, "How much more? How much more? Come on, how much more?" And I finished it, and he goes, "Well, all I can tell you about that sexual inventory is it was entirely selfish." Mark that down in your mind. That's a selfish inventory. Okay, selfish. And then I read the ideal relationship paragraph, and I'm living the ideal relationship paragraph today. I'm married to Lisa. We've been married to almost 7 years. It's February 22nd is our anniversary. I waited 16 years for her to show up. I just knew that I didn't know how to do relationship stuff. And it's kind of like putting a plug in the jug. I just put everything up on the shelf and waited. And my requirements were a longtime member of AA, which she is, a non-smoker, which she is, and the great power that I function within had to make the situation very obvious. Because I don't get the women signals. You know, women send out signals like, I missed them. I don't know how they do it. I must have missed that part in Catholic school, grade school, when they gave those notes out. But that's not on my radar. I don't know anything about that. So when she showed up, she was very obvious. After the fifth step, reading this stuff to Forrest in his garage, he gave me a list of defects of character. I had 23 of them. And he said, "Now, you've done a very good fifth step. Fifth step is over. These are your sixth step instructions. You are to go home and get a dictionary out," the other big book, dictionary, "and look up all of these defects of character and write out in your own hand definitions of each defect of character." And then we'd get up from the card table and go over to the garage door, and he would stand inside the door, and I'd be on the outside of the door, and he would say, "If you don't do this part," and he would push the button, and the garage door would start to come down, "I'll never speak to you again." So I went home and looked the definitions up. It took me about 4 days. And called him, got the definitions done. Oh, great. Come on over to the house. Hour and a half, card table. And I showed him the list. He goes, this is a great list. Here's the instructions for the seventh step. Never heard this anywhere before. It seems to be a West Coast thing under the Dr. Bob tree of sponsorship out of Akron. For 30 days, you lay out your written out definitions and you use the seventh step prayer on each definition each time. You plug that defect and the definition into the seventh step prayer and you read through all 23 defects of character. Once in the morning, once at noon, once at night. You can do it different times, doesn't matter, just as long as you do it 3 times a day, 30 days in a row. You miss a time or you miss a day, you go back to zero until you get 30 days. And I know, guys, it's taken 2 years to get 30 days. But it took me, I started on the 4 days after that, I started my first day. And the instruction was to call his number at 10 and leave the message that I'd done my three and what day I was on. That's it. No stories, no how you doing, you know, none of that stuff. Just what the information. And I started, and my 30 days were up, and Forrest was on the road out of town and couldn't reach him. So I called his sponsor, Gary. And I said, I can't get Forrest, and I got my 30 days. And Gary, you're going to love this. Gary says, well, just keep going. That's it? Yeah, just keep doing it. Oh. So when I had 56 days, I hooked up with Forrest again, and we had our little meeting. And he began to explain to me how the defects work. It's never one defect. It's usually one defect triggering 9 or 10 that pile on. And then you begin to experience the fear. Everybody feels the fear in a different way. I usually feel it right here at the bottom of the breastbone or at the top of my legs where my hiney meets my leg. It starts to sweat, flop sweat, nervous sweat, those two places. And then all the defects are pushing and pulling on me, and it's time to stop. And we have a drill in our sponsorship tree. It's called the wait a minute drill. Wait a minute, what is this? And usually, it starts with judgment. Judgmentalness is not discussed anywhere in this area, but the judgmental defective character is the vivid trigger. Once I judge you, then I can resent you. Once I'm resenting you, then I begin to be afraid of you. Once I'm afraid of you, then I have to project into the future of how I'm going to take care of this. And then I have anger and usually gossip. Yeah, that's 7. So my instruction was to begin to study how the defects kick in once I get to the drill. And that's all 7-step work. And then I went back over the hill to the card table and we did an 8-step list. It took me about 4 minutes to do the 8-step list. And I resented all the tour speakers, the guys that travel around speaking at the conferences, you know, the big deals, you know, the super guys. He says, you want to know why? You resent them? I go, yeah. He says, oh, we'll talk about Johnny. Everybody know Johnny from the West Coast, L.A.? He says, do you know where Johnny is right now? Well, I was obsessed with Johnny. You know, I knew every meeting he went to. I knew sponsees. I had phone numbers. I had emails. I, you know, all of it. He goes, see, you're connected to him. You're carrying him around. You're dragging him around. So, you know where he is right now? Tonight at the meeting he's going to go to? Yeah, he's going to be at Bellflower. Well, you drive down there and you get a nice meal. Well, you know what to do. Click. So I left Santa Cruz and I drove down to L.A. and got a nice meal. Drove out to his meeting. Pulled him out during his break. Made amends to him. He agreed that I had a great sponsor. He told me about the fact that he could feel the judgment and the fear in people that would pick him up at the airport, which was me, when I was in New York in the beginning years. I was part of the Unity Breakfast Conference. Speaker, getter at the airport or task. And he explained that he can feel the judgment and the fear and the anger. And it opened the door for me. And I made amends to everybody on that list. And the number one guy on my list I had never made amends to, because every sponsor told me just to leave him alone. That's your amends to him. Just leave him alone. Forrest said, I'm not going to use the word he used, blank that. You have until midnight tomorrow to find him and make amends to him, even if you've got to fly to the East Coast. You want to know why? Yeah, why? Do you know where he is right now? I go, yeah, he's a bar owner. He's probably mixing drinks behind the bar at the club that he owns. And he goes, you have phone numbers? Oh, I got all the phone numbers. The ex-wives, the girlfriends, private line in the office, the two car phones. I got them all. He goes, okay. You go home and you try to get him on the phone. If you can't get him on the phone, you're flying east tomorrow morning. You have until midnight tomorrow morning, which is 9 p.m. West Coast time. So I went home and called all my numbers and didn't get anybody, left a lot of messages. About 5 in the morning, my phone rings, and it's him calling back. Hey, it's Kevin. What's up? Kevin, this is old. This has to do with my drinking. I need a minute of your time. He goes, sure. I said, I've judged you. I've resented you. I was very jealous of your sexual activity with all of the groupies that would follow you around. I was upset that you would lie to me about not having sex with any of them. He always told me he was a good Catholic boy, never had sex. No. Until I 12-stepped three or four of the girls, you know, and then you find stuff out. I said to him, I've gossiped about you. I've been afraid when I'm in your presence and when I'm talking about you, I have fear. And if any of this stuff has gotten back to you, I hope to be forgiven. Silence. He said, well, you were a pain in the ass, but you were helpful. So I hear Jerry Garcia is going back out on tour with the Dead. I go, oh, yeah. Well, they're rehearsing and they're going to go back out on tour. I couldn't reveal to him that Jerry was in a flophouse dry out farm trying to get off alcohol. Jerry's problem was alcohol. It was never drugs. He used drugs, a lot of drugs, but his problem was alcohol, and he died while trying to get off the alcohol. But I couldn't reveal any of that to him because it was ours. And talked about Garcia and the Grateful Dead and the tour. Bye, click. Oh, I turn the alarm off. I roll over and go back to sleep. About an hour later, Forrest calls me. Did you get him? Yeah. Just got off the phone with him about an hour ago. Made amends? Yep. How do you feel? Very different. Good. Who's next on the list? Back down to L.A., find Clancy, because big time. I had big resentments about Clancy. And pulled him into a ladies' room and made amends to him because I knew nobody would come in. And he says, who's your sponsor? He goes, I said, Forrest. Do you know Forrest? He goes, he's East Bay, right? I said, you know everybody. He goes, I've been sober forever. You get to know everybody. Not everybody knows that I know them, but I know a lot of guys. A lot of people know me that I don't know, but I know a lot of guys. And the whole nine-step thing gave me a whole lot of freedom, spiritual freedom. I do a written 10-step. I keep a written 10-step with my money, my cash money in my wallet. I add stuff and I strike stuff off it as it's current events stuff that this will be struck off now that I'm here and doing this talk. I've done it, strike it off. You know. Written 10-step, current stuff. 11-step, we have a meeting that we run in our house on Sundays that we canceled today so I could come here. Where we read spiritual authors that are non-AA authors that carry the message of the greater power that we live amongst and under. Emmett Fox was the first author that I was taught to read. Sermon on the Mount book is still available. The second half of the book is the Our Father. I was told to read it and study it and begin to have spiritual experiences in the meetings, after the meetings, when we're saying the Our Father. And that began to happen right away. Joel Goldsmith, another great author. The current guy that's really doing a lot of great work is Neil Donald Walsh, Conversations with God. And Wayne Dyer, excellent. His stuff is excellent. 11th step, broadening the God concept and trying to open up to newer things that I'm unaware of, because I was a Catholic. And part of being Catholic is a lot of unlearning. When you get out of that, you have to unlearn a lot of stuff that really isn't so. And the 12 step, the big thing about the 12 step is practicing the principles in everyday life, like holding the door for people, like not yelling at the waitress, like driving the speed limit. You know, let the people doing 90 go by instead of drifting into their lane, you know. Truth, I got to tell the truth. You know, I'm not, you know, I'm 98%. I'm not 100. And this, what I've just done is the 12 steps. So I think I ran over. So I'm done. Thanks.